From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. The Environmental Protection Agency's Superfund list is a virtual who's who of some of the most polluted sites in the country. From 1980 to 1995, the cleanup at those sites was funded primarily by a tax on the oil and chemical industries. But that tax was allowed to expire, and the EPA has since struggled to complete its work. Scott Gurian reports on efforts to reinstate the tax and what it would mean for the residents of Old Bridge, New Jersey.
The Superfund controls contaminated areas where the original polluters have either run out of money or gone out of business. Without the tax on industry, its budget comes entirely from taxpayers. And environmentalists say the Raritan Bay slag site is a perfect example of why that alone is not enough. On a peaceful day at the beach, people stroll along a path and water laps gently against the shore. But you won't find anyone swimming. That's because the sand is fenced off and there are warning signs and security cameras to keep people out.
See the red? There's one layer of big rocks beyond the sand, and then some of them look like bowls that are cut in half.
Robert Spiegel points to what look like roundish, rust-colored chunks of rocks. It's slag from the bottom of old blast furnaces that local companies put here in the late 60s and early 70s to build jetties and retaining walls. Though it's been decades, testing shows the slag still leaches high levels of lead, arsenic, and other heavy metals hazardous to both people and wildlife. With officials estimating the cleanup could cost hundreds of millions of dollars, Spiegel, who runs an environmental group called the Edison Wetlands Association, says this is like a mini version of the oil spill in the Gulf.
People in Old Bridge and in Sayreville, they're being held hostage here. They're not going to be able to sell their houses. They can't use this beautiful beachfront that they spent millions of dollars to renovate. And they're being told to wait because the EPA has to clean up the site. Now, this could be done on an emergency basis if EPA had the money, but Superfund is broke.
Enter Senator Frank Lautenberg, the New Jersey Democrat who chairs the Senate Environment and Public Works Subcommittee that oversees the Superfund. Since the tax on the oil and chemical industries expired in 1995, he and his colleagues have introduced legislation every year to reinstate it. But now, with the support of President Obama, it has a good chance of becoming law. Lautenberg says it's not fair to make taxpayers pick up the tab.
If I didn't cause the problem, I don't want to pay for the problem. I'm willing to pay a share, but I want those companies, where the exposure is likely to come from, to pay for more of the cleanup than I should as a average citizen.
The senator has said that what this is a polluter pays tax. In fact, that's wrong.
John McKinney is a New Jersey attorney who's represented companies involved in Superfund litigation.
I like to paraphrase Pogo, the cartoon strip, to say that I have met the polluters and it's us.
He argues that many sites are former municipal landfills where everyone from individual households to companies to the military sent polluting waste over the years. And he says we all benefited.
You had industries that could get rid of their waste cheaply. The society didn't have to pay the true costs of disposal at the time. Now that we do have to pay the true costs of disposal, that should be handled by society.
By which he means taxpayers. Wherever the additional funding comes from, environmentalist Robert Spiegel warns that until it arrives, sites like Raritan Bay Slag continue to worsen by the day.
That fence doesn't stop the chemicals from going that way every single time that the tide comes in and out or it rains. And so, you know, unfortunately, the sign in the fence doesn't do anything, really. It keeps honest people out, you know, but the chemicals don't know any different, and the toxic waste that's here certainly doesn't.
Senator Lautenberg estimates his bill would generate up to $2 billion a year of much-needed revenue for the Superfund Trust Fund. He's working with the Senate Finance Committee to get it included with a package of energy taxes after Congress returns in mid-September from its summer recess. For NPR News, I'm Scott Gurian.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. The U.S. economy is sputtering. That's the message from the latest monthly jobs report out today. The Labor Department said private sector employers created just 71,000 jobs last month, not even enough to keep pace with population growth. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The report says the U.S. economy lost 131,000 jobs last month. The drop was so big in part because so many temporary census jobs ended, leaving a lot of people out of work. But even if you just looked at the private sector, it was still a weak report, says Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute.
This is a disappointing report. It really showed a snapshot of a labor market on pause.
About the best thing that could be said about the report was that the total unemployment rate held steady at 9.5%. But that was mainly because 181,000 people grew so discouraged about finding work and stopped looking, and so they no longer show up on the government's unemployment rolls.
Some of the potential employees are saying it's a waste of time to look for work, so I'm going to drop out of the labor force, and they don't count.
Sun Won Son is a professor of economics at California State University. On the whole, the labor market is growing again and has been doing so all year. Private employers have added 630,000 jobs so far. President Obama chose to emphasize the positive during an appearance at a small sign company in Washington.
The fact is, we've now added private sector jobs every month this year instead of losing them as we did for the first 7 months of last year.
The president also pointed out that manufacturing jobs grew again last month. But the president acknowledged that the job growth is still slow.
For America's workers, families, and small businesses, progress needs to come faster.
There were other parts of the report that don't bode well for the future. When the economy is improving, employers usually start hiring temporary workers, and so hiring in the sector is seen as a harbinger of job growth. But last month, the number of temporary jobs fell slightly. At the same time, hiring by government fell significantly. State and local officials are facing severe budget pressures in many places, and they're laying off teachers, police officers, and other municipal workers. Economist Heidi Shierholz says that will add to the pressures facing the economy.
The private sector is going to have to grow that much faster to make up for the losses that we're seeing at the state and local level, and we're just not seeing the private sector poised to be able to do that right now.
This week, the Senate passed a $26 billion aid package to states and school districts that should help stem some layoffs. But today's report suggests that a lot more will be needed to get the job market growing again. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Back in 2008, the federal government recommended that parents take steps to minimize the exposure their kids might get to a chemical called bisphenol A or BPA. Among the recommendations, throw out those scratched plastic baby bottles and caps. Don't heat plastic in the microwave. I'm sure you've all heard about them by now. Well, they may want to add another recommendation to that list. Keep kids away from cash register receipts. According to a story in this week's Science News, three new studies show that some type of cash register receipt, you know, the paper that comes out of the cash register, have significant amount of BPA on them, BPA that can easily get transferred to skin. Joining me now to talk more about the study is my guest, Janet Roloff, senior editor at Science News. You can find her stories on BPA and receipts at sciencenews.org. Welcome back to Science Friday, Janet.
Hi, Ira.
Give us a little background first. What is bisphenol A?
Well, it's the basic building block of polycarbonate plastics. Those are those clear plastic products that you find all over the environment, especially in your kitchen. Every food processor bowl, many of the glasses in the cupboard, lots of spoons and stuff like that, they're made from this plastic. It's very commonly used.
And it's the stuff you throw into the microwave.
What? It can be. It
yeah.
certainly can be. It's also an ingredient in a resin that's used as a dental sealant for kids when they get trying to seal the teeth from cavities. And it's also that same basic resin is used as a liner in an awful lot of food cans to keep acidic foods from eating away at the metal in those cans.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about these cash register receipts. How did anybody think to even look there? What's the story on this?
Well, it turns out that there is this green chemist in Massachusetts who used to work for Polaroid. And while he was working for them, he'd heard about the formula for making some of these receipt papers, things that were thermal papers so that they would print when they got heated, or pressure-sensitive papers. And he remembered that they had bisphenol A in them and sort of it was a curiosity, nothing more. And then all of a sudden, about, you know, 5 to 8 years ago, BPA started getting all over the news, far more than just in the pages of Science News. And he said, wow, I wonder if that stuff's still in these receipt papers. So he, at that time, was teaching and had some of his chemistry students collect some receipts and start testing them. And every year they came up with the same, you know, finding that a large share of the receipts had a large quantity of BPA in them.
Does it get transferred to your fingers when you touch the receipts?
Well, he didn't look into that. He just started measuring that. And, in fact, his first formal publication of those data just came out about a week ago. But there are some others that started looking in the meantime. One of them was the Environmental Working Group, which is a public interest research group based here in Washington, and also a Swiss group. This was the Official Food Control Authority of Zurich. And they both started looking at not only concentrations in cash register receipts, but also, and not just cash register receipts, this could be your ATM, right?
Right.
But also to see if it rubbed off, because in fact, this BPA is in a coating that's placed on top of the paper. And it's sort of loosely there. It was sort of described to me as a little bit like talcum powder. It isn't talcum powder, but kind of like that, laced with some of these ingredients that under pressure or temperature, a dye will mix with the BPA if it's there and, you know, print something on the paper. So this stuff could actually come off in your fingers, and they measured how much. And in fact, it does. A large share of it just does transfer to your fingers. And the Swiss study showed that after a while, some of it's not even, you can't get it off the fingers anymore, which suggests that it started to go into the skin. If it goes into the skin, how far does it go? Does it go to the bloodstream? Nobody knows. But there are studies planned to look at that.
So we don't know what kind of threat yet this poses to anyone.
What they do know is that where these receipt papers are using BPA, and they don't all use it, probably about a little less than half do, that the exposures you can get, the amount that goes onto your hands, is probably greater than from any other source in our, you know, for most people, certainly for non-workers. Now, the question is, if it gets onto your hands, does it go in? If it doesn't get into your body and, you know, get into tissues, then that's not a problem. But the Swiss chemist I was talking to, this Kony Grope, he was mentioning, he said, under worst-case scenario, you've got maybe hand creams or oils to, you know, try and keep your hand comfortable, and that could facilitate the uptake of this into tissue. And he said the worst-case scenario for him would be a woman who's pregnant and uses hand cream or something, touches receipts all the time, like a cashier. And if this is truly getting in, she could be exposing the fetus, and that's the big risk because the fetus and young children are the populations at highest risk for potential harm from BPA.
And what kind of potential harm are we talking about here?
Well, and it is only potential. Right. They've shown that it definitely can cause some real problems in animals, usually animals exposed to fairly high concentrations of the chemical. But in a number of studies, they have started finding suggestions that it may be contributing, or in animals, it causes obesity, it can lead to diabetes, it can lead to heart arrhythmias, and they think the same kinds of things could operate in people. In children that were exposed in the womb to BPA, and they can tell that by looking at concentrations in their mom's urine during pregnancy, those who had the highest exposures, the girls tended to be more aggressive when they become, you know, young children, and the boys became a little more sort of reticent. So there was some question about whether gender-appropriate behavior might be affected. Those are early studies, but it's got a lot of people worried.
But the government at this point isn't making anyone stop using it, making those paper cash receipts.
No, it's perfectly legal, and there's been some question about whether there is even any ability to regulate it right now because it's generally considered safe. So until it gets a different designation based on toxicity studies, and there's a lot of controversy over whether it changes at what dose it might pose some kind of risk. No, they can't change anything.
Is there a useful alternative chemical that
might be used? There is a major receipt paper manufacturer, Appleton Papers of Appleton, Wisconsin, and they also sort of saw the handwriting on the wall about 4 years ago and said, you know, this stuff is getting a lot of bad press. We think that this is not what we want to use in our receipt papers. They had been using BPA. So they switched to an alternative, bisphenol sulfonate. And it sounds similar, but it doesn't mm-hmm. work the same way.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from a tweet came in from Pete Myers. It says, ask Janet about transfer of BPA from receipts to hand to mouth. I mean, if you work at a cash register all day and you're taking these out all the time, if you put your hand on your tongue to grab it or something, is there a danger here?
Well, interestingly, both the environmental working groups researchers who are looking at that, and that for their team, it was at the University of Missouri, Frederick von Saul's group, and the Swiss group both looked at what happens if your fingers are wet when you touch this versus when it's dry. And you get 10 times greater uptake of the bisphenol A from the paper if your fingers are wet. Now, also, there's some question, would it be easy to take up in your mouth? And, I mean, mm-hmm. my mind, the biggest concern is if you're worried about children being exposed to the chemical. It gets on mom's hands. Does it then, when she holds a child's hand, get on the child's hand and the child puts his hands in the mouth? Or does the child play with the receipt and mm-hmm. put it in its mouth if it's mm-hmm.
And what do the BPA makers say? How do they respond to this?
They said that much ado about nothing at this point, that the risks have not been established, that the federal government has not taken action, and that's true, and that some of the studies suggest that exposures would be well below what should be a tolerable or acceptable dose. Now, the Swiss group said that's true maybe for a receipt, but not if you're handling them all day necessarily. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, to show some measure of the interest, the feds are interested. The National Toxicology Program, and of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, is looking at the data and considering beginning its own research to look at the uptake of this from paper and how far BPA may get into the body and under what conditions. Mm. In addition, there's another study that's going to be underway at the University of Missouri looking at a similar sort of thing. But the EPA has also looked at, since it doesn't have the authority right now to restrict use of BPA, it's encouraging companies to do so. And on July 15th, it had a workshop to bring together all kinds of receipt makers, the people who use receipt paper, environmental groups, other government agencies, and it said, what can we do to try and encourage people to use safer alternatives? And that's, they're brainstorming that right now.
Mm-hmm. And so no one is saying right now, don't touch the papers.
Well, up until 2 weeks ago, nobody really thought much about it. It wasn't on anybody's radar screen.
Interesting.
And in fact, you can't, by looking at the receipt paper, tell which ones have BPA and which ones don't. And I talked to some people at Appleton Paper a while ago saying, if this is a concern for some people, might you not want to put, something on the paper that says it's BPA-free for those people who are concerned, to alert them which papers they might want to touch or not. And they said, well, nobody's really asked for it. Well, that's changed. In the last 3 days, they said, Janet, we're in the process of working on it right now, that their phone is ringing off the hook from retailers asking, how can we get receipt paper that says it's BPA-free?
Yeah, especially if it's being recycled, all that paper, right? Going into the recycle stream, it may have the BPA
in
it.
Yes, as a matter of fact, apparently almost all recycled paper now has BPA in it as a result of having recycled the thermal paper that had used BPA. And Appleton Paper, which has been trying to avoid BPA, actually stopped using outside recycled paper for that reason. It now uses only its own internal thermal paper, which has no BPA, because I think it was finding it was getting traces of BPA from other waste streams.
Yeah. All right. We'll keep an eye on it with you, Janet. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
Keep up the good work. Janet Groloff is senior editor at Science News. You can find her stories on BPA and receipts at sciencenews.org. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Danica McKellar is here with her new book, Hot X, Algebra Exposed. And she's going to be here to talk about it with us. 1-800-989-8255. If you want to talk about algebra and teenage girls and best ways to get teenage girls interested in mathematics, she's devoted a good part of her life to doing that, and she's here to talk about it some more. So stay with us. 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll be right back.
Will Ferrell stars in The Other Guys, a new comedy directed and co-written by his longtime collaborator, Adam McKay. It's a spoof of the buddy action cop movie and co-stars Mark Wahlberg as his mismatched partner. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
At capturing the poetry of male obliviousness, Will Ferrell has no peer. Consider his preening Ron Burgundy in Anchorman, his swaggering yet befuddled racer Ricky Bobby in Talladega Nights, his golden-locked skater Chaz Michael Michaels in Blades of Glory, child men who put on macho airs and look more and more like great big babies. In his one-man show, You're Welcome, America, Ferrell portrays George W. Bush as an over-entitled rich boy posing haplessly as a Texas cowboy. Best of all is his infantile 39-year-old Brennan Huff in Step Brothers, which is, for my money, the great American slapstick comedy of the last decade. Along with his director and co-writer, Adam McKay, Ferrell created an environment on set in which a lot of gifted, unself-censoring actors and actresses had license to say and do anything, take after take. The upshot was gorgeously controlled pandemonium. The latest Ferrell-McKay collaboration is The Other Guys, a buddy cop comedy, and the bad news is that it isn't in the league of their last few. The good news is that even a second-tier Ferrell-McKay comedy is better than almost anything at the movies. Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg play New York detectives Alan Gamble and Terry Hoyts, both in the shadow of hot dog cops played by Samuel L. Jackson and Dwayne Johnson. The movie opens with Jackson and Johnson on a high-speed chase, jumping in and out of cars and trucks while blowing stuff up and trading one-liners. The problem is there's no visual wit, just expensive mayhem. It looks too much like the action films it's parodying. The Other Guys gets better when Jackson and Johnson leave the picture on a high, and Gamble and Hoyts try to fill their shoes. Ferrell's Gamble has tight curly hair and wire-rimmed specs and is a study in wonkish repression. He's an accountant by training. He never wants to leave his desk. On the other hand, Wahlberg's Hoyts has been confined to his desk after shooting a major sports figure under circumstances I won't spoil. Hoyts wears black leather sports jackets and impugns Gamble's masculinity, finally resorting to animal metaphors.
I don't like you. I think you're a fake cop. If we were in the wild, I would attack you. If I were a lion and you were a tuna, I would swim out in the middle of the ocean and eat you!
Okay, first off, a lion swimming in the ocean? Lions don't like water. If you'd placed it near a river or some sort of fresh water source, that makes sense. But you find yourself in the ocean, 20-foot waves, I'm assuming it's off the coast of South Africa, coming up against a full-grown 800-pound tuna with his 20 or 30 friends, you lose that battle. You lose that battle 9 times out of 10. Did that go the way you thought it was going to go? Nope.
Oh! Oh!
That's coffee being dumped all over Ferrell's shirt. The case the pair stumbles into has something to do with Steve Coogan as a high-risk money man who's billions in the red, and Anne Heche, who's seriously underused, as the head of a multinational conglomerate at risk of collapse. The plotting is loose, but the Wall Street setting isn't arbitrary. Over the closing credits are graphs and captions, the ratio of CEO salaries to workers' salaries over the last few decades, the amount of bonus money given to executives at companies taking bailouts. I wish, instead of another buddy cop movie, they'd made a comedy about a money manager or broker. What saves The Other Guys is that Ferrell and McKay let no scene go until they've turned its apparent premise inside out. The sheer accumulation of absurdities is dizzying. Ferrell's Gamble turns out to have a complicated backstory. He's married to a smoking hot doctor played by Eva Mendes. He's trying to be a wonk to keep the violent pimp inside him at bay. Opposite Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg doesn't so much send up his own peculiar combination of thuggishness and sweetness as play it absolutely straight, no winking. And he's hilarious. I look back over my notes on the movie and find myself choking with laughter. The Prius, Dirty Mike and his homeless orgies, Good Cop, Bad Cop, Jersey Boys, Sarcastic Ballet, Christine. You don't know what I'm talking about, but if you see The Other Guys, those words will have you doubled over too. What makes Will Ferrell such a treasure is that for all the lowbrow gags, he doesn't satirize stupidity. He satirizes fear, the lengths to which men will go to keep from looking vulnerable. I'm excited by what might come down the road. A great business comedy? A great black comedy of war, like Duck Soup? Aim high, Will, and get low.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, species die out all over the world in remote places we never hear about. But there is one species that is dying right before our eyes in our lifetime. We've been talking about it for years on this program, and now a group of scientists writing in the journal Science says that there's a 99% chance little brown bats, once a very common species, may be extinct in the Northeast within the next 16 years. What's killing them? Is it this fungus we see on the bats, the white nose syndrome? Or is that just a symptom of some deeper problem? Scientists have spotted infected bats as far west as Oklahoma now. Could this infection soon threaten bats all over the continent? That's what we'll be talking about at the beginning of this hour. Our number 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry and join the discussion on our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guest. In fact, we have up on the webpage a bat video, a tour of a bat cave where the bats were falling victim to a white nose disease up there on our website. You can take a look at that. We did a couple of years ago. That's how long this has been around. Winifred Frick is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of California, Santa Cruz and Boston University. She joins us from the studios at Boston University today. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Frick.
Thank you, Ira.
What is the situation today with the bats? Where has the white nose syndrome been found so far? I say it's as far out as Oklahoma.
That's correct. You know, it was first discovered in Albany, New York in 2006, but this year, and every year we've seen a huge increase in its distribution, but this year was really the worst. It made it up to Quebec and Ontario provinces and Canada and as far west as Oklahoma, as you mentioned, as well as far south as Tennessee. So we've seen it spread halfway across the continent.
And how fast do you think it could make it over the Rockies to the West Coast?
Well, that's a good question. Faster than we would like, I'm sure. One of the distressing things about the record in Oklahoma was that it was found on a new species, Myotis vellifer, which is the cave Myotis, and that species happens to have a more western distribution. It makes it all the way to California. So we could very likely see it into the Rockies this winter and even further west in the Rockies. Mm-hmm.
And in your paper, you're predicting that there's a big chance these bats may be gone in 16 years, at least from the Northeast. How do you come up with that number?
Yeah, so what we did was we took two very extensive data sets, a 17-year record of mark recapture, which is Scott Reynolds went out and captured little brown bats in a maternity colony every year, starting when he started his PhD here at Boston in the early 90s. And so we had a really good record of the annual variability before white nose hit of the survival of little brown bats. And then we also looked at historic records collected by New York Department of Environmental Conservation and Pennsylvania Game Commission of counts of bats at hibernating sites. And sort of meshing those two data sets to look at the natural variability in the populations before white nose hit, we learned that the populations were actually doing fine. They were healthy and thriving before the disease was discovered in 2006. And then we took the information from caves that have been infected since 2006 and looked at the mortality, the empirical evidence of the mortality at those caves. And we put all that data together in population models and asked the question, okay, if given the natural variability in the system and the known mortality that we've seen, if those population dynamics continue, if the mortality and the spread of the disease continue the way we've seen them for the past 4 years, what will be the chance that these bats will be on the landscape in 20 to 100 years? And that's where we got that very dire prediction.
Yeah. Well, you see the fungal infection, the white nose, on all the bats, but you're not sure if that's the cause or possibly just a symptom of the problem, right?
Well, we're scientists, and we like to be very careful and not be definitive, but until something's really proven. But, you know, we have very strong evidence at this point that the fungus Geomyces destructans is strongly associated with white nose syndrome. It is what's growing on the bats. It grows on their wings and causes the necrotic and scarred wing tissue, and the bats are waking up too frequently during their hibernation, and they're starving to death. So we refer to it as the putative pathogen, because we have to satisfy Koch's postulates before we can say for sure that this pathogen causes the disease. And that work's ongoing and being done right now.
So it's not the fungus. They're not being shred to death by the fungus. They're waking up in their hibernation period, going out, freezing and starving to death is what's happening.
That's what we think,
And why would they wake up from the fungus?
Well, we're still working on some of those details, but we have what's called the itch and scratch hypothesis, which is that perhaps the fungus growing on them irritates them. You know, is anybody who's had athlete's foot knows that those kinds of skin fungal infections can be very irritating. And so perhaps that it could be that they need to mount an immune response, and their immune systems aren't active while they're hibernating, and so perhaps they know they need to try to mount their immune response, so that's why they're waking up. A lot of researchers are working on these sort of mechanisms of death questions.
Mm-hmm. So they wake up, they fly out, they starve to death, and I understand that this is not the first case of this kind of bat death, that it occurs in Europe also.
Well, we have confirmation that the fungus, Geomyces destructans, the same species of fungus, has now been documented on a handful of species in a number of countries in Europe. But what we're not seeing in Europe is the symptoms of the syndrome, so the aberrant behavior flying around in winter, the scarred and necrotic wing tissues, the loss of body fat, and then we're not seeing the massive die-offs in Europe either.
Isn't that interesting?
It's interesting, and it may be a ray of hope. I mean, if this fungus has been around a long time in Europe and the bats there have, you know, evolved with it and learned to coexist with it, then that could be a big ray of hope for us here.
Mm-hmm. Last year, we talked about the possibility of building warm bat boxes inside the cave so that the bats wouldn't freeze after losing their fat. Has that been tried?
Yes. Yeah. So Justin Boyles and Craig Willis, who were the author of that paper, tried that this winter, and unfortunately the bats didn't use those boxes. And you know, this is a case where, you know, because we're facing such a major crisis, people are really sort of thinking outside the box, if you'll excuse the pun, and trying to come up with as creative options as possible. And so I applaud Dr. Boyles and Dr. Willis for thinking, you know, putting an idea out there. But at this time, it doesn't look like that's going to be the saving grace.
Let's go to the phones. Ken in Alfred, Florida. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've been following this for a couple of years myself, and it's really worrisome indeed. My understanding is that the white nose fungus is an opportunistic, and that what I'd heard was that there's a problem with the bat's digestive system, something about key enzymes showing up missing, or not showing up, as it were, and that they were burning through their fat stores much faster and therefore waking up and trying to eat. It'd be nice to keep them warm during this time, but what they really need is something to eat. Can you speak to this research about the lack of enzymes, and is there anybody actually coordinating the research? Is there funding adequate?
Yeah. Okay, good questions.
Yeah, those are great questions. In terms of whether the fungus is opportunistic or not, there's very compelling evidence that this was a novel introduction of this fungus to the North America, because we don't have any record that this fungus was growing on bats in North America beforehand. And we actually have very good data on that, because people were taking photographs of bats in hibernating caves for years prior to this, and people have gone back and looked through those photographs. And you would expect, if this was opportunistic, you would see it sort of flare up from time to time, and we we also have a very clear pattern of spread, that it really has spread from an epicenter and radiated out, which is another good indicator that there was a point source and of introduction. So, you know, early on, people weren't sure, and that actually motivated our work to try to understand how the populations were doing before 2006, because you would expect that if this was already present in the system and somehow the bats were just sort of succumbing to it now, that there'd be other indicators that the bats were in poor health, and that data has showed that they were doing fine prior to 2006.
Do these bats eat mosquitoes?
They do.
That's a huge problem if you lose all these bats, and what happens to the mosquito population?
Well, that's true. I mean, we're basically in the middle of a terrible natural experiment about what happens when you remove a very abundant species that plays an important role in terms of ecosystem services. They don't eat exclusively mosquitoes. They eat a wide variety of insects, and some of those insects are agricultural pests and forest pests, as well as some mosquitoes in the diet.
Mm-hmm. There are frogs dying all over the world from a fungal infection. You have bats dying now from fungal infections. Could there be some kind of link between the two?
Well, there's no link between the two fungi that are the chytrid fungus that's attacking amphibians and this Geomyces destructans that's attacking the bats. But it does speak to the broader problem of wildlife disease and pathogens creating significant risks to species. And in the case of white nose, the potential role of humans moving pathogens around.
Mm-hmm. And there had been talk about using fungicide on the bats. That hasn't worked. Or is not practical either.
That's not practical for a number of reasons. One is, as anybody knows who's had athlete's foot, to use that analogy again, that a lot of fungal infections require multiple treatments. And so the idea of trying to treat bats with an antifungal, say, as they're entering a cave would be very difficult. The other thing is we can't just go in and mass spray inside these caves, because these caves themselves are valuable ecosystems with other rare or endangered species. And we can't just go in and mass spray inside a sensitive ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll just have to wait and hope for the best and keep track of what's going on. Thank you very much. Dr. Frick, for joining us. Winifred Frick is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Boston University. We're going to take a short break, switch gears, and talk about cooking for geeks. Yeah, you're a geek, like to cook. Maybe we're going to have some interesting ways that you can cook, how to turn... there's so much to talk about. I don't want to give it away. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Jeff Potter, Cooking for Geeks. And your questions, 1-800-989-8255. Or you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll be right back.